You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
Okay, welcome back. This is our third discussion of the afternoon. This one is about autofiction. Just to remind you, you are at Ecstatic Prose. This is hosted by Triple Canopy. The time is 4:30 p.m. Okay. So this next session is called autofiction, and autofiction is a literary modality of ambiguous verite, in which the narrator may or may not be the writer. The writer may or may not be the author, and the author may or may not be I. And we have three very esteemed panelists. To my immediate right is Andrew Durbin. He is the author of Mature Themes, which was published by Nightboat in 2014, and the chapbook MacArthur Park from Kenning Editions in 2015. His work has also appeared in BOM, Boston Review, Flash Art, Poetry London, Texter Kunst, and elsewhere. He's a contributing editor at Moose and co-edits the Press Wonder. He lives in New York. His first novel, Blonde Summer, is forthcoming from Nightboat in 2017. And, oh, right. We had asked everyone to, in our discussions before today, we had asked everyone to select a text that resonated with them in terms of the themes that we'd be discussing today. Maybe something that influenced them, something they'd want to push back against. And Andrew selected an excerpt from Gary Indiana's Resentment, which was originally published in 1997, but was reissued by Semiotext in 2015.
And I have the pleasure of introducing Tan Lin, who's at the far right. He's the author, most recently, of Seven Controlled Vocabularies and Obituary 2004, The Joy of Cooking, and Insomnia and the Aunt. The recipient of a Getty Distinguished Scholar Grant and a Warhol Foundation Creative Capital Arts Writing Grant to complete a book on the writings of Andy Warhol. He is also working on a novel called Our Feelings Were Made by Hand. And Tan selected a short fiction that was recently published in the Brooklyn Rail titled False Accounting, highly recommended, as well as an article by someone named Yus de Bluis, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but I hope that's okay, titled The Artists Formerly Known As, Ellipses, or, comma, The Loose End of Conceptual Art and the Possibilities of Visual Autofiction. And lastly, I will introduce Jonathan Sturgeon, seated at the center of the table, who's a writer and editor based in Brooklyn. He was formerly an editor at N Plus One, eFlux, as well as The American Reader, and now serves as the literary editor at Flavor Wire. And the text that he selected for today is Charles Olson's essay thing called Proprioception, which is published in the book of the same name. So without further ado, please welcome the autofiction panel.
Hi. I'm a critic, and we've already been talking up here that we're worried that we might not know what autofiction is. But I'm not gonna read the proprioception piece by Charles Olson, even though I think that's really important. The main takeaway from that piece is Olson's idea that the corpus or the body of work is sort of the same as the self or the soul, and that that metaphor, I think, is sort of shot through all autofiction. I think the idea that the corpus is the self or the soul is the most important thing, because auto means self, but proprio also kind of means self too. So sometimes I think we should call it propriofiction. But it occurred to me that autofiction was a thing, like a real thing, in April of 2014, when Ben Lerner reviewed Karl Ove Knausgaard's, I think it was volume 3 at the time of my struggle for the Lerner Review of Books. It was a very important review, and it sort of, you know, James Wood has that line that like a genre is hardening. It made it clear to me that although autofictional writing has a long, long history, that it, that something new was happening, or that it was restarting. So in December, I wrote this really bombastic, kind of like eureka piece. And now I disagree with about half of it, but it was this, you know, when you have this aha moment, when you think a genre is hardening, I think that's what happened. So I'm just going to read a little part of it. The postmodern novel is no longer what William James would call a living hypothesis. No committed literary novelist would now choose to write postmodern fiction. Sure, genre and YA novelists may continue to churn out commodified, page-turning, loosely Victorian versions of the postmodern novel, but the robust fictional project of Pynchon, DeLillo, Coover, and even David Foster Wallace no longer holds sway over literary writing. In 2014, instead, many of the best novels were autofictions that vigorously reasserted the self. By this, I mean that the self is no longer drowned in a system of disinformation or paranoia in the vein of Pynchon and DeLillo. Nor does the self get washed away in an ocean of hyper-reality or unreality. Nor is it beholden to the logic of late capitalism, at least not entirely. We're witnessing instead the induction of a new class of memoiristic, autobiographical, and metafictional novels, we can call them autofictions, that jettison the logic of postmodernism in favor of a new position. Midway through Ben Lerner's 2014 metafictional novel 1004, the protagonist, a man named Ben, visits the Institute for Totaled Art, where he holds a Jeff Koons sculpture that has been shattered by a hurricane. As an artwork in a gallery, the sculpture was once valuable, expensive, the embodiment of postmodernism, or what the critic Frederick Jameson famously called the logic of late capitalism. But now, in fragments in the protagonist's hands, it's worthless. It has been liberated, Ben says, from the tyranny of price. At the close of Nell Zink's 2014 debut, The Wall Creeper, the unreliable protagonist briefly mourns the death of her young husband before rejecting this mourning altogether. But unlike, say, Ralph Waldo Emerson grieving for his son, she refuses to see her husband's death as a foundation for her own life. Instead, in a move resolutely against the grain of postmodern fiction, which is often defined as a distrust of meta-narratives, she embraces a single powerful meta-narrative. She will believe exclusively in her own life, which is composed of the story she tells herself and others. The novel, surprisingly, at the end, becomes a Kunstler roman. In May of 2014, writing for the Lerner Review of Books, Ben Lerner wrestled with volume 3 of Karl Ove Knausgaard's My Struggle, a novel that is often called the In Search of Lost Time of its generation. Only Lerner notes that in Knausgaard's novel, unlike Proust, nothing is differentiated. A cornflake is as important as someone's face. Everything, Lerner suggests, falls under the sign of Knausgaard's looming figurative death. He refers to the novel as a literary suicide note. He calls it a Kunstler roman. And then he writes, breaking of the vessel of art, the renunciation of fiction, literary suicide, these are fictions. They're the devices on which the power of my struggle depends. Elsewhere, in an interview in The Believer, Lerner explained about his own novel, and I'll end after this. My concern is how we live fictions, how fictions have real effects, become facts in that sense, and how our experience of the world changes depending on its arrangement into one narrative or another.
Okay. Thanks. It's great to be here. I'll start with an autofiction. I was having a drink with Lucy two nights ago, and she said, oh, it's so nice that you're going to be on this autofiction panel. And I said, I really don't know what autofiction is. why did you put me on this panel? So I went to the internet and I looked up a few things, and I have these things which I'm going to read, and they're bulleted, so I think that makes it easier. Okay. The identity of the author and the main character are the same. And yet, as Bart notes in SZ, one is still compelled to ask, who is that speaking here? Or maybe there, I'm not sure. Two, autofiction foregrounds acts of citation, quoting, and translating. Three, there are a couple of genres that surround or percolate through autofiction. That would be fiction, autobiography, history writing, and testimony. And these are subject to, I think, different levels of verifiability. So history might subject events to a certain verification, and testimony might subject or might interrogate the truth of experience. Okay. Let's see. Three. There's an interest in the production of authority in an anthropological or historical or scientific sense, and thus issues having to do with the verifiability or accounting are foregrounded. So, and I have two sub-points here. One, a referencing of particular events of a verifiable nature. These might be a death. B, referencing of particular objects as objects with a specific and verifiable history of use and ownership. And in my case, I did this piece for the rail. It had to do with cars that my father owned, make and model. There's an underlying warrant here, and I think that is that the process of fiction making bear a direct relation to the life lived in some sort of way. And this is also evident in works of testimony, particularly things touching on the Holocaust. The use of documentary materials or ethnographic materials that have been gathered by the narrator work somewhat paradoxically to demonstrate the, quote, ambivalent position of all factual data, photographs, passports, and they work to destabilize the, quote, indexical capacity of photography. These items are not so much verifiable indicators of historical truth as part of some larger fiction that merely looks like the truth. The use of documentary materials hints at the non-singularity of the text, that it might at any point destabilize into a non-literary work, i.e. just a collection or anthology of materials out of which some work might or might not be created eventually. So there's a temporal dimension, and I think this touches on genres too. Okay. Oh, so I'll end with another autofiction. So I was having, well, I woke up this morning and my 11-year-old daughter had made pancakes for us. That's true. And while we were eating pancakes, I was reading John Froh's book on genre, and I'm going to read one bit of that, if I can find it. Okay, so a modal term that suggests that some of the non-structural features of a kind are extended to modify another kind. If we call Emma a comic novel, we mean that Emma is by kind a novel, by mode comic, Fowler, 1982. The modes start their life as genres, but over time take on a more general force which is detached from particular structural embodiments. Tragedy moves from designating only a dramatic form and comes to refer to the sense of the tragic in any medium whatsoever. Pastoral modulates from the gorgic or the eclogue into a broader form which can be applied to any genre that deals with an idealized countryside populated by simple folk. Exhausted genres such as the Gothic romance may survive in their modal form, quite spectacularly so in the case of the Gothic mode, which passes through early Victorian stage melodrama into the stories of Edgar Allan Poe and the novels of Charles Dickens, and thence into the vampire novel, the detective novel, and a number of other narrative genres, and more directly from melodrama into a range of Hollywood genres, including the old house movie, film noir, and the contemporary horror movie. Equally, modes like genres may themselves become exhausted. Fowler cites the heroic mode as one that has become largely obsolete. And at that point, breakfast ended.
Hello, hello. It's not as hot right now, so that's kind of nice. I am like Tan in two ways. One is that I am a poet who is now writing fiction, and two, I also didn't know what autofiction was, and I never expected to be held accountable for it. So I have to say, I didn't really prepare in any kind of like intelligent way. So I just kind of, I wanted, when I was asked to think about this term, which I hadn't heard of, except for maybe in like, someone said it at McNally Jackson and I overheard them, I was trying to think of where this idea came from and where I fit into it. And for me, I guess these kind of concerns, a lot of the concerns that Tan that particular article describes, began for me with actually poetry and sort of the poet's novel, particularly like John Ashbery and Robert Creeley, continuing on into new narrative in the late 70s and early 80s, and the kind of concerns that were elaborated by people like Robert Gluck and Long Note on New Narrative. And I know this is something Jonathan talks about in that essay he read from, but Chris Krauss talks a lot about the importance of queer fiction as sort of being the precursor to this genre. And I guess I wanted to read just a passage from, I mean, one thing that we were asked to talk about in this panel was what was at stake in fiction of this kind for us. So I'm going to read from this Gary Indiana novel. It's the first in a trilogy of novels about true crime novels, but they become much larger than that. And I want to read this section where he talks about a certain dynamic, which I think gets at the heart of his fiction, but also what I think autofiction or my fiction or whatever generally is interested in. So this character, Seth, is at a restaurant with this guy named Mark, and this is toward the end of the novel. It is a fact, he goes on, that waiters and restaurant managers and bartenders are more starstruck than anyone else. They pretend to be jaded and indifferent about their daily contact with well-known people, but in fact they brag to each other and everyone else who comes into the restaurant, who comes into the bar, Seth says, not all waiters or restaurant managers or bartenders, of course, but for a vast majority, to be spoken to by a well-known person gives them a feeling of intimate association with that person. But of course, at the same time, the waiter or restaurant manager or bartender knows that this well-known person would never recognize him again, would certainly never recognize him outside the restaurant or bar. In fact, most people can't tell one waiter, restaurant manager, or bartender from another. And this interchangeability is a source of unending resentment for people in the so-called service professions. Most waiters, restaurant managers, and bartenders in New York and Los Angeles, Seth says, are in a state of constant resentment and barely contained revolt against their condition as servants, precisely because their servitude brings them into contact not merely with ordinary people to whom they feel equal or even superior, but also well-known people to whom they feel utterly inferior. Because they see this well-known person drinking and eating and using the lavatory just like anybody else, they get the idea that this well-known person isn't extraordinary at all, and that they themselves, the waiters and so forth, could easily do whatever this well-known person does. This leads to the delusion that they could actually achieve far greater things than the well-known person, who is simply eating his dinner and completely unaware of the raging resentment his presence is causing, has achieved. They begin to believe this well-known person is a fraud, who is taking up the space that rightfully belongs to the waiter, restaurant manager, or bartender. Before this well-known person entered their restaurant or bar, it seemed perfectly natural for the well-known person to be well-known. His accomplishments were secure, but now the waiter has a chance to observe this public person gratifying the same prosaic needs with everyone on earth. Oh, I lost myself there. Shit. Don't put that in the transcript. His accomplishment, okay. But the waiter, now the waiter has a chance to observe this public person gratifying the same prosaic needs that everyone on earth has to gratify. And perhaps the servant, who already resents his servitude as a matter of course, has a chance to observe the personal pathology of the public person. It's a fact, Seth continues, that most well-known people are even more fucked up than the general run of humanity. They are driven to accomplish extraordinary things because they are deeply and dangerously wounded in some part of their being. They are impelled by their own pain to impress and dominate others with their accomplishments, and the people they are driven to impress and dominate are precisely these waiters, restaurant managers, and bartenders who envy and resent them. That's an amazing novel. You should all read. But I guess what I'm interested in how fiction will take these kind of situations, this particular dynamic, a kind of dynamic of resentment on one hand, but also a kind of interaction between the extraordinary and the ordinary. I mean, that's, I think, what is kind of at the heart of autofiction is taking one's life and making it into shaping it into a narrative that is compelling, that says something, that I guess elaborates a kind of argument on multiple levels, whether it's on the level of the story or on the level of theory or whatever it might be. And I think, I guess what I'm saying here is I'm just trying to run an advertisement for Gary Indiana, because I think he does this really, really well. And in the book that follows up this, that's followed up with this, is 3 Month Fever, which actually takes that dynamic and blows it up into the story of Andrew Cunanan, who is a serial killer who killed 4 people before killing Gianni Versace. So it kind of goes in that direction. That's all I have to say on autofiction.
Well, when we were emailing before, you were also interested in you had a kind of ethical question about autofiction, because if there's one thing I can say about all these autofictional books is that there's something kind of just there's something kind of selfish about the idea, something narcissistic. It's even kind of approaching decadent. I mean, when I read Nausgaard now, it feels almost decadent. But you were wondering, and I had never thought about this, and maybe this is like the solipsistic reason why I'm so interested in autofiction, but you were wondering, like, what's the author's responsibility to these other lives and other characters in the novels?
Yeah, I mean, it's like disturbed fiction often. Like, you know, I mean, you look at a lot of. So we were asked to present some questions, and the question I had put to everyone in light of 3 Month Fever, which is a strange. It occupies a very strange ethical place because Indiana reconstructs Cunanan's 3 month killing spree and sort of the 10 years that lead up to it, based on testimony from Cunanan's friends and things, but actually a lot of it just occupies Cunanan's personal mental space in a way that I thought raised a lot of interesting ethical questions that could be extended to how, I mean, everyone from Bob Gluck writes about his lovers to how Chris Krause writes about Dick Hebbidge or something. And I was interested in what the other panelists thought about the ethics of that, because I've never been able to personally resolve, as someone who writes about friends in a way that essentially exposes them to personal embarrassment or criticism or an audience that they had not anticipated they would have in interacting with me. I'm always curious about that violation, and in writing it, I'm always struggling to negotiate the lines that are kind of drawn between me and my friends and acquaintances.
Well, I mean, I found Andrew's piece, the Indiana piece, very interesting, because in some sense it plays with, you know, just in keeping with what we're talking about today, sort of issues having to do with genre and genre expectations. And one of the things I kept thinking, we're set in a restaurant, right? So one of the things I'm thinking here is, oh, okay, we're in the realm or the genre of a restaurant review in some sort of way. But this is clearly an unwritten restaurant review, and it's a novel. It may even be pathological in some sort of way. So I think it's just interesting that a number of different sort of genre and expectations. I mean, if you weren't going to write a restaurant review and you were to write something else, but you were set in a restaurant, this is maybe something that would evolve. So I think it's sort of interesting in terms of genre and certain expectations that one brings to, again, the setting here.
One word you use that I find really sensitive in autofiction, that where it might seem obvious, but it seems more sensitive in autofiction, is just the word life. Because sometimes you're talking about the lives of these other people, and because the membrane of fiction is barely there, you know, there's a lot of responsibility. I mean, Nausgaard famously almost drove his wife to suicide, and but I think that what sets me off there is the word life. I mean, sometimes we call this writing like life writing. You know, that's a word that gets thrown around sometimes, even though I don't really know what that means. But there's a sense of, in reading this stuff, when you read a lot of it, that it hews closer to questions of life. And a lot of these writers are really, Nell Zink, to the extent that her first novel was autofictional, or Ben Lerner, it's not just, and it, Ben, you know, they're really into questions of the environment and life, and, you know, in that sense too. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what, I feel like Nausgaard doesn't, I think he thinks that in real life he has ethical responsibility to these people, but when he's writing the book, I think his fidelity is to himself, his self, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when you're constructing a narrative or a book, I mean, you ultimately are focused on creating an object that in the end won't bear that much resemblance to life, even if it's ostensibly autobiographical. But I'm interested actually in going back to what Tan was talking about, this kind of genre flipping that happens within autofiction, whether or not you could... I think what this kind of fiction excels at is when it takes one genre and does it within... I guess maybe the Fred Astaire thing, doing everything backwards in a high heels. Who is that? Who said that? Ginger Rogers, you know? I mean, I think that's when the... correct that in the transcript too, please. I think that's when the it does it really well, is actually when it takes something very different. And I think, like, going back to the poet's novel, I'm a huge fan of Leslie Scalapino, and, you know, she'll do like a detective novel in sort of very elliptical verse that's very difficult, and she calls it writing on the rim. And so I'm interested in how these genres can be turned inside out and made into something else. And I guess I don't know where that's...
Well, your question was whether autofiction is a genre, and then you read the thing in Brett Breakfast. Did you decide if it... Did you make a decision?
Yeah, I'm not sure what a genre is. I mean, the sort of temporal dimension of a genre is sort of interesting, and also a genre is a sort of a performance of some sort. So in that sense, you could look at autofiction as a performance, and one of the materials that it uses in that performance is our genres themselves. So autofiction is going to play with specific genres that have been sort of laid out in advance and that set up a series of expectations. And then it's going to play with those materials or score them in a different way. So issues having to do with citation and translation and all these things become sort of crucial to autofictive works. I mean, that's one way that one could think about it. It's sort of a process-based thing as opposed to a sort of rigid taxonomic system that involves some sort of theatrical role-playing within a set of genres and the situations that create those genres, which are sometimes institutional, sometimes they're social and cultural, sometimes they're historical, but all these things condition, I think, a series of genre expectations. And I just think that's an interesting... Well, it's an interesting game to play, but I think anyone who does any writing thinks about genre before they even start the writing activity, so.
Well, I met Gary Indiana one time, and we had a couple of drinks, and then basically the one thing I remember him saying was that he wanted to die before all of his books went back out of print. And that actually strikes me as a really, like, auto-fictional thing to say, because I think it's, like, shows an interesting preoccupation with the self, really. But I guess that's, like, you know, that's the root question here, is that auto is self, and what, you know, I don't really know where I'm going with that.
I mean, I'm interested in also why sort of death is intersected with a lot of autofictions, and it's just an interesting question. I'm not sure why exactly. I mean, certainly a death is a verifiable event in someone's life, but if you're writing, it hasn't happened yet. So this poses, I don't know, philosophical quandaries, right? But certainly the idea of, you know, of a sort of projected death or a death of somebody else, for example, figures often sort of heavily here. And I'm not sure why. This is something maybe we could all talk about.
Yeah, there's a St. Peter-like quality to these books. There's like this feeling that they're, like if you think about Nausgaard in particular, that he's trying to get the self all out on paper, and that he's almost that he's going to be judged for it, basically. I don't know. Do you feel like that when you write?
That I would be judged.
Yeah. Do you feel like that you're?
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Is what you write synonymous with yourself?
No, I mean I think that's the other. I mean I really the reason I maybe don't like this term autofiction is I'm not so interested in this conflation of autobiography and fiction. I mean, I think that, of course, there's an element of that happening, but I think it's maybe a bit too easy sometimes in how, when I do encounter writing about the books that I guess we're generally talking about, is this, there's a real desire to read into that some kind of story of an author. I mean, and this is very basic. I mean, this is back to, like, you know, not conflating the I with the writer, but I still see this desire both in readers to do that, but also a desire in writers to do that. And I think one thing that I do in my own work is to exploit the degree to which I anticipate people will recognize me in that, but also to kind of counter that narrative. And I think maybe one other hallmark of autofiction is this desire to kind of present a kind of counter argument or counter narrative to itself in many ways. Like, when these kind of fictions introduce long passages of sort of documentary material, as to return to my friend Gary Indiana, like in 3 Month Fever or something, it's almost like a argument against his own fiction's ability to actually tell this story or to actually account for Cunanan. So I'm interested in the tension that builds there.
Well, and I was reading, when I had read Andrew's Mature Themes, what was interesting to me about it was that the sort of the specter or the filter of personality that's allowed to sort of percolate through the material is clearly being sifted or filtered through various sort of roles that are tied to cultural criticism for me primarily. And so the expression of personality in the case of Andrew's work was extremely hard to pinpoint or pin down. And it was so closely tied to various social and cultural forms of writing, but also particular, you know, part of this stuff sounds very academic to me, so it sounds very institutionalized in its own way. So you have this sort of production of a writing self, and it's, you know, it's autobiographical too also, but it's a combination of a number of different factors that work together, and they're at play against each other sometimes.
And I mean, I'm curious, I mean, there's two poets on this panel. I'm curious, Tan, actually, to get your feeling about how poetry intersects with this particular genre, you know, and to the degree that it actually does. I mean, I think something like Joy of Seven Controlled Vocabularies, I mean, even in the title, is sort of playing with this idea of genres being flipped, and that's something that your work constantly circles around and plays with. So I'm curious how you see these two intersecting.
Yeah, I mean, the larger question here, I think, is sort of what, you know, why has there been a sort of diffusion or expansion of the sort of, or porousness about the sort of traditional boundary, you know, genre boundaries? They don't seem to exist in a way that they used to. And it's not clear exactly why this has happened. A lot of the sort of, you know, aggrandizement of the self or the gathering of materials that would create a self can now be done online. I think that maybe has something to do with it. So there's a lot of data aggrandization that has to do with self-formation now. And there's a lot of personal archiving that takes place in sort of web-based practices that have to do with visual accumulations of material that are cued to self-making and memorialization of particular events and life events and all that sort of stuff. So I think all this is happening now. But No, I haven't pieced any of this together. So I just think we're in an interesting place in terms of talking about identity and self-formation, and also you know, just how we live our lives in various venues.
Sometimes I think of the of cinema and other arts, but especially cinema in the early 2000s was doing a lot of this with people like Pedro Costa and Lisandro Alonso. There was a kind of new push, you know. There was always like Jean Rouch or somebody like that, but there was a kind of new push that was blending these documentary and fiction forms, and it seems like more and more people are just interested in narrative. Like, the obsession is just with narrative. It's not. I think there's this the idea that fiction is like a set of lies or make believe or something. I don't think people really buy that now. I think they're just interested. Well, but I think there's a qualitative difference between auto-fictional stuff and like the old postmodernist stuff. It has something to do with. I go back to life. Like, there's some idea of living. It reminds me of Kenneth Burke, where you know, a critic back in the 20s and 30s who saw literature as equipment for living, kind of. And it, to name another auto-fictional book, How Should a Person Be? I mean, I think those two ideas go hand in hand. But yeah, I guess that goes back to the ethical component.
I think what Jonathan's saying is very interesting, but I just wanted a little clarification. So because I think the distinction between postmodern fiction and autofiction is an interesting one, but how would you summarize the differences?
Well, because there's this idea in postmodern fiction that the self is always fighting a losing battle. The self is drowned in systems, you know, there's entropy, there's, you know, these big... Pynchon, DeLillo, Gaddis, like all these people. And now I think there's like an assertion of the self again. I think that the self, as long as the self is, as long as we accept that it's like a story, then it is allowed to thrive. And I think for these writers, it thrives against where, you know, in the postmodern novel, it would have just dissolved. That's Nausgaard, for example, I think.
I have lots of things. So I keep thinking of, like, well, this is interesting, but it would be interesting to see, like, who were the sort of earlier figures you were, like, earlier fiction writers, and Andrew's already highlighted a few. And for me, I keep thinking of, like, André Breton's Nausea, for example, is very important for me, and Kathy Goes to Haiti also. And Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing in America. For some reason, these resonate for me as kind of auto-fictive texts in their own weird way. And then I'm also thinking about the sort of notion of narrative itself and what Aristotle said about sort of inferior narratives, i.e. that they were episodic in nature. And I feel that my interest, at least in the last 5 or 6 years, has been in sort of not longer overarching narratives or meta-narratives, but anecdotal episodes. So I just add that as a.
I agree. I mean, that on a personal level, I'm interested in episodic narrative, and I mean, I think we're kind of circling around a similar problem where we're seeing all of these kind of novels which would easily fit into this category, 50, 60 years old. So for me, this kind of category, I don't know. It's like seems like something that. As a writer, I don't really think about that kind of stuff, the difference between autofiction, postmodern, when I'm actually working on things. So it's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around. And in particular, I want to get back to this idea that you mentioned, this equipment for living, because it's a kind of idea I really resent as a writer. And I don't think that's a helpful way. That's a terrible way to think about books, and it's a terrible way to think about art, because it's going to get you nowhere. It's not going to solve anything, but I'm curious about the idea that maybe these books, as being so kind of nakedly about someone's life in some way or another, could be viewed as a template or something. I mean, I hope people don't. I mean,
Andrew's, I think, raised a very interesting idea here, which is someone should write an experimental self-help book, I think. But that would actually be fascinating to see.
Better living through criticism. I mean, that's like, think of the A.O. Scott, the title of the A.O. Scott book. I agree. I am really wary of this too. But think of the title of that book. Like, that's another Burkean, like, how should a person better living through? It's self-help, like self-care.
Or the how Proust can change your life or something like that. Yeah. Like that kind of trope people drag out every so often. It's just, anyway. Did you want to?
I had a kind of auto-fictional insertion as well, because Ton made me begin reflecting in this way, and I had a memory of something that had happened to me as a child, or a thought that had come to pass as a child, and I suddenly thought maybe you guys could help me out with this. So as a child, I had the realization that there was a problem with writers writing, in that writers knew how to write and like to write, but many people who are living don't know how to write so well and don't enjoy it very much. And therefore, the world that many novelists were depicting was a world in which writing was not only a joyful thing, but a thing with which they had facility. And therefore, the world was somehow skewed to reflect this, that the world was somehow skewed to be representable. And I always thought, you know, a novelist shouldn't write a novel. Someone else should do it, so it won't be so damn subjective, you know? And thinking about that in the ethics that you were proposing, Andrew, something that occurs to me that's a problem about autofictions is that the protagonist of the autofiction can go over and like rearrange the interior of the room if they want to. Like, another character can't do that, but a protagonist or the narrator of an autofiction can, you know, walk up to this pitcher of water and say, actually, that's dolphin-shaped. And, you know, now it breaks, and now it does this and that. And so the world of autofiction seems less one of revelation than this, like, constantly really fraught obfuscation of anything that might be fair. It seems like an incredibly unfair kind of writing to me. So I'll just put that to you guys. And especially to you, Ton. That's especially to you.
Yes, I agree. It's cheating. Shouldn't do it. Never.
So interesting, your thought as a child, because what happens in novels is that because people who write them like to write or hate to write but have to do it and value writing, that they will perhaps place that at the center of a book. And what you get with autofiction would be double or triple that in some sense, you know, that would be even more central, that I am writing this and you pay attention to what I'm writing. But I wanted to say one other thing. Well, I have actually other things to say, but I think your view of postmodernism or what the postmodern is a little limited for me, because I see it as bringing in other voices. At the time that, let's say, Craig Owens wrote about postmodernism in art and in relationship to feminism, but in relationship to queer issues and black issues and women's issues, there was an explosion, a real change that happened that I include within the postmodern, not just Coover, not just the metafictional. I think that was one strand of it. And to me, that's really high modernism. That was the sort of death of high modernism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that Glick talks a lot about, is the, I mean, seeing new narrative as a response to the kind of, like, closed the closure of language poetry as this this other kind of writing that could explode voices and could bring them in, and this kind of as an explicitly postmodern project. So I agree, Lynn, with you on that.
I'm basically just using Frederick Jameson. I'm basically just doing Jameson. I mean, I do think that there, maybe to your point, it makes me wonder back to figure like Charles Olson, who's really, really important to even Garth Greenwell's novel that came out this year that's really great. He's been talking about the proprioception thing. Ben Lerner's talking about the proprioception thing. Brian Blanchfield, who the person read from in the last session, talks about proprioception in that book. And that's like a tradition of writing. I don't know that much about Charles Olson, to be honest. But I think that goes back to the poet novel and the poets. I think that, like I said before, when I presented this, I disagree with like three quarters of what I said. But the one thing that's become clear to me is that poetry's in-between quality is one of the... There have always been poets' novels, but it's come back in full force, not just in the novel, but in the essay. I mean, think of like Maggie Nelson, the stuff that she's done for a long time now. But there does seem to be a bit of the poet's revenge on these other, not revenge, but, you know, it's bad. Like, it's
revenge.
Yeah, it is revenge.
I mean, it's like a lot of things got thrown out, and now suddenly, you know, it's all these poets writing amazing novels that don't really have a whole lot to do with plot, but...
I think there are questions in the audience.
I wonder if we couldn't... some of these questions about whether the autofiction is post-postmodern, like, I mean, I would think that, like, actually, if you read across, you know, the 20 things you might call autofiction or whatever from the past 5 years, it's almost like you could have an account of competing ideas in the contemporary world of what the self is and how it's constituted. From Knausgaard, which seems unreflective in a certain kind of way and maybe interesting for other reasons, Tan, and Andrew, I'd like maybe each of you to talk a little bit more about your own writing practice. I mean, Tan, you said I don't write autofiction, but like the way I kind of read your prose work is often about, you know, reconstituting sometimes factual, sometimes fictional family history and identity through often Google searches and all other kinds of things and you know, having this very synthetic sometimes fictional. I mean, there's a very complicated sense of self, and you know, I think that like autofiction, I mean, what's interesting is reading across is like some people have all these different answers, most of which are unsatisfactory in some way, but like it's in that kind of failure to be satisfactory that I often find the most interest in reading these problematic, annoying books.
Well, one thing that I have sort of thought quite a bit about is just this sort of, and this is again to return to the earlier question, i.e. what sort of meaningful distinction can be made between sort of autofiction as a genre and postmodern fiction. Well, it's a very large category, as you point out, and I wouldn't even know where to sort of chart its historical beginnings in some ways. I mean, because I think of a lot of different things in this category, you know, Donald Bartlemy too, Snow White, stuff like that, for me, falls into all those sorts of categories. But I think for me, there does seem to be increasing self-reflexivity in a lot of autofiction. And at least, this is just in reference to my own work, but the sort of genres of fiction and nonfiction are sort of primary. So it's interesting for me to sort of be able to step into those two genres more or less simultaneously, or to try to understand what the relationship between those two things is in terms of writing. And there are histories for this now, you know, they come mainly for me within a sort of sociological and anthropological tradition, you know, the James Clifford and Marcus's work on writing culture and the predicament of culture are all very much imbricated, I think, in the use of ethnographic or anthropological models of determining authority and identity, and in the ways that the writing process alters the culture that's being observed. I would say here the thing that's being observed are the categories of fiction and nonfiction in some ways. And the work that I'm interested in is sort of played with those. But, you know, people read this work in very different ways. You know, the thing of mine in the Brooklyn Rail, people read and said, they asked me afterwards, well, can we see a copy of the book of the cars that your father made? And of course, there isn't one. I made it up. So, I don't know if that's a useful thing, or as Lucy said, is that kind of cheating in a way? Because in a way, I want it to be true, and in a way, I kind of, there's something else at work too. I'm just saying it's complicated.
The question is, and you were bringing this up. I mean, it's something that really drives me crazy, frankly, which is the conflation of true with nonfiction and untrue with fiction. And I guess autofiction wants to straddle that. But of course, there's fiction in autofiction, which means that, as everyone else does in writing a novel or fiction, you're representing something, and it's not, you're not pouring yourself, in quotes, onto the page. So those questions of representation maintain themselves. One other thing that comes to mind, which might interest you, is that not so long ago I was out in San Francisco to do a reading, and I was with Bob Gluck, and we've been friends and new narrative writers, so-called, since the 80s. And I said, you know, it's funny, you and Dennis Cooper and Kathy Acker, all put your names in your book. This was in your books in the 80s. And I said, I never wanted to do that. I never wanted to have to identify myself, you know, put Lynn Tillman in. And Bob said, well, he wanted to complicate the relationship between the author and the narrator. And I said, well, I thought reading was complicated enough. But I'm also thinking about history and the 80s being the time of the AIDS epidemic also, and the assertion among queer gay writers or people who, fellow travelers, with wanting to name, wanting to put the name there. This is my name. I am here writing this book.
I think it's really interesting that the word real hasn't come up yet. When I think about why is there death in so-called autofiction, for me it has everything to do with realism and death being the kind of marker of the real, and that being like the last trace of realism we get in autofiction, which is also reality fiction, right? And so we're living in a time in which narrative is not interested in realism, but is interested in reality. And I'm curious, like, if there's a reason that you guys were avoiding these words, or it, like, if you could, if you have anything to say about them.
Wasn't Jonathan using the term?
No, life, but not real life. Which I was just, like, really struck by that.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of maybe answer both Sam and yours questions at the same time, I mean, thinking about my own work, I'm interested in reality as this kind of, like, as it exists in sort of this heavily mediated space. Like, in my own work, particularly in my first book, I was really interested in fan fiction, you know, and sort of presenting myself in a series of situations that could resemble fan fiction. In my book, like, I have dinner with Katy Perry, and I end up being the producer of the Paul Schaefer film, The Canyons, or the writer of it, and things like that. And I guess I was interested in playing with this idea of reality as something that was kind of a flexible thing that existed between, I guess, real life and a kind of dream state. And the interesting result of that, sort of similar to what I guess you faced after the piece came out in the Brooklyn Rail, was so many people asked me if I had dinner with Katy Perry or if I someone at a reading one time got really mad at me because there's a piece in my book about jerking off to the movie Clueless. And he was like, that is so gross. And of course, I've never done that. So, you know, I mean, but I was interested in how those, how, I was interested in creating these situations of reality that are shifting and flexible, but also refer to very real situations within the context of very odd situations.
But so what do you think it is about your writing that that makes people believe that it's real? Because I could imagine some other style, perhaps. Maybe it has to do with style. I could imagine someone else writing as, you know, I could write something as Sarah and maybe write that, and it would seem much more, I could write it in a style that would seem to give away that it was invented or fictional. So what is it about your own style then that would lead people to believe you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think probably one thing is that usually the speaker resembles me in many ways, you know, and it's pretty obvious if people hear me read that it's maybe me. I also think that I wrote my first book in a very intentional, flat, plain language that didn't rely on a lot of heavy detailing, so it created situations where I think you could probably read a lot into it. I don't know. I actually have no answer to that.
Do you have any sense of why people would ask you for the car book, for instance?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, I've always thought, as I think Andrew sort of just said, that real life, whatever that is a highly mediated event of some sort. So maybe that's one reason we didn't use those terms. I'm not sure that answers your question. Yeah, I mean, this sort of notion, I mean, real life, it's like reality television.
Well, that's what I was, sorry, that's what I was thinking.
It's highly scripted in all sorts of ways, and there are all sorts of expectations that come with even that definition and that phrasing, and it incites a very, very specific set of audience expectations and literary expectations and thus genre expectations, and these contracts are not sort of made explicit. They're mostly sort of warrants, you know, in some sort of larger argument about some sort of agreement that you want to reach with the reader. But that's an interesting place to be. It's quite a theatrical place.
So I'm glad someone, thanks guys, by the way. I'm glad someone brought up reality television because I was wondering, reality television is sometimes critiqued for a lot of things, but one of them is that it's cheap and it's easy, and nobody has to write a script. Although it's somewhat scripted, it's not real. It's like a really cheap thing for MTV to put on a reality television show because partly it's not challenging, it's not difficult, the writers don't have to work very hard. Without asking too insulting a question, what about the lack of creativity in auto fiction?
Well, I think actually reality television is an interesting comparison to autofiction because it doesn't necessarily privilege the right writing. I mean, I think reality television might not have a great script, but it has really great editors, you know, who kind of create a narrative. And I think that's I don't want to get into who I've met, but, you know, when you talk to people who've worked, what? I actually had a conversation with a reality television editor, not anyone particularly important, hasn't worked on any great shows, but even on the shows that he's worked on, he says, he talked to me about the experience of editing, which is a four-day, never-sleeping, intensive process for every episode, and they all sit there and they construct a narrative, which is a really interesting model for me in thinking about how to approach narrative, because a lot of times when I'm working, I'm kind of cobbling together different texts and then editing them into a narrative. I mean, a lot of what I do relies heavily on found material. And so that is a really interesting comparison. And I don't know if I would call reality television, I think you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you called it cheap.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying not to use a lot of critical words, also because people have subjective ideas about what art is and what's good. I think that it's not great.
Right.
I was interested almost in saying, my question was almost going to be, is it possible that autofiction is bad fiction? and that people, right, and that people aren't writing fiction in what a reader originally hoped for, which is a complicated, false, new, different world in which people do things that are created.
I would say that, but I would say that autofiction isn't at odds with any other kind of fiction. I would say that it still operates with many of the same. I mean, writing changes in its concerns, but the construction of a novel, whether you're writing whether you're Charlotte Bronte or Chris Krauss or Sheila Hedy, who we brought up, I don't think it changes that much. I mean, in the sense of
partly recorded the conversations of her friends, right?
Right. But that's I guess I just don't see it as cheap or bad, because I don't see, I mean, that, this is, you know, she's just incorporating life in a different way. It's a different strategy of composition that, you know, I don't think you could really privilege that over someone writing it out. I mean,
I think I was just interested in playing, for a second, we could all pretend like we were going to maybe privilege and make a hierarchy. I think
right.
It's interesting to think about it for a second.
Right.
Is it possible that it's... You know, I think like Zadie Smith said something like, oh, it's going to make, it makes her feel, at one point she was saying it was sickening to think she's going to create a Jane to talk to a dick, and the dick was going to talk back to the Jane or something. And
right.
But is it possible that like, you know, what, like what's the interaction of that problem with like writer's block?
Yeah.
Right? Is it possible that you can't think of something to have Jane say, and it's much easier if you have a tape recorder?
Right.
Anyway, I'm asking difficult questions. That's the end of it.
Point out that someone like Knausgård thinks that his writing is bad. Like, he says that it's bad. And it's bad on purpose. Because I think what Ton said about you're making a contract with the reader, there are lots of different ways to do that. So there's lots of stylistic variation in autofictional writing. I mean, some of the poets' novels we're talking about, don't read like Gary Indiana, don't read like Ben Lerner. Ben Lerner and Knausgård are obsessed with many of the same things. They don't read similarly at all. There are lots of different ways to create that reality effect.
I just wanted to bring up, you use the word false, and the word untrue has been called here, and I'm sure Andrew, maybe Tan, when people found out that you hadn't actually had dinner with Katy Perry or something, they say, oh, that's a lie. Now, the question is, where does the imagination lie? And why, and I don't mean lie, I'm not punning on that, but why is it that fiction, which is very similitude, can't be considered true? In other words, that one's imagination, which one is also using in any kind of writing, whether it's essays or whatever, that there is such distrust for that. And, you know, on television, this is based on a true story. And I say, true story? What does that actually mean? Okay, actual, this something happened. But this mediation, this representation is a created thing. And even I would say, I've used recorded conversations, although nobody seems to have noticed them in novels.
That's privileging imagination. Right?
Yeah, yeah. But you could use that record. I know that I edited the conversations that I recorded for No Lease on Life. I didn't use all of them. I'm sure Sheila Hedy chose what she felt she needed for her novel. So that question of making something is always there, as you're saying, Andrew. It's going back to the idea of true. That's where I always return, that fiction has its own truths. And to deny those because of saying, well, this didn't actually happen, seems a very sad commentary on what we read for or why.
I mean, just to return to your question again, from my particular perspective, which would be sort of, some sort of experimental fiction slash poetry perspective would be, well, what's the least amount of work that I can do to make this read as a quasi-narrative? So, I mean, in that sense, the experiment is very, very tightly controlled from the outset, and I don't have to worry about it too much, and that's a starting point. But that's not everybody's starting point, and as John has pointed out, we're all going to start off with different places and try to do different things with the found material. So.
I've been thinking about, over the past year, encountering Claudia Rankine's work in Citizen and Don't Let Me Be Lonely, and I'm sort of surprised, or not surprised in like a judgmental, like, oh, I'm surprised. But like, talking about an experimental half fiction, half poetry sort of narrative that comes together and works in the autofiction space a little bit. I think that there's, when you get into the politics of autofiction, there's also, you know, certain writers for whom there's something else at stake when they're trying to separate the author and the I. Just historically, if a person hasn't had that privilege of being able to write I and having that I not be immediately connected with the author. So I find it interesting that in with this sort of upsurge of autofiction, there's people who we might look at and say they're doing something solipsistic, and there's by being like self-reflexive in that way. And then there's people who are working with the same, I guess we're calling autofiction a genre or whatever it is, the mode. There are people who are using it for, you know, a different sort of project, which gives a complexity to the movement that I think makes it seem, like something to be encountered, and I guess we're all encountering it. So, I was wondering if you guys have anything to say about that.
The fact that Citizen hasn't come up or any number of books, I think it speaks to how muddied these distinctions are between these things. I guess it was even an issue when it was nominated for both nonfiction and poetry and the National Book. You know, that obviously became something in that book, and that book is explicitly about both the I as super connected to the writer and also disconnected and by a kind of number of intervening political and social forces. So I guess I'm interested in that. I mean, you know, it's hard to kind of figure out where all this fits in. Like, why doesn't a certain 19th century novel fit in? Why don't we talk about Abdella Taieya's work, you know, or something like that? I mean, there's all these kinds of ways in which it's hard for me personally, and this kind of gets back to what I was saying at the beginning, I don't really fully understand what the demarcations are. Because I see these strategies in poetry. I've been looking at these strategies in poetry for forever. So, and I've been seeing it in, lots of novels. It's one reason why I brought up Gary, who would never be someone who would. I guess people wouldn't call him autofictional, maybe now, but at the time, no one was thinking about it. He would certainly resent that term a lot. He'd kill us for even.
Thank you. I just want to preface this by saying that I'm not a writer. I'm a musician. And what you seem to be troubled by with truth and non-truth or fiction and non-fiction is analogous to something that's problematized in music a lot of the time, which is what is the work? And I think what you're questioning, I'm surprised that what hasn't been brought up is what you're doing is closer to interpretation or performance via the vehicle of writing, and whether this performance, this written performance, is more, well, this written interpretation is more akin to a performance of interpretation. So there's this essence of circularity about what you're doing. So it overthrows, in my mind, the question of what is true and what is not true, because it is represented in a written form, it kind of steps outside this boundary of truth and non-truth and that kind of dialectic. And I was wondering if you, sorry, getting to the question, I was wondering if you consider what you do closer to performance and interpretation and how that plays into your writing.
Well, I'll just say that in some ways what we've said already was an attempt to say that autofiction is a performative genre, i.e. the genre needs to be conceived of as a performance. And one of the materials that autofiction does is it performs things with genres. In that sense, well, I mean, I think a poem, it's true of any poem. When you read it, you're performing the poem. It's a score. So a poem really isn't a finished work. It's a score that's performed by any number of readers. And that social setting is very important for how a work is read and how empathy transfers. And the Rankine, I think what's so interesting about that book is the pronouns. I mean, I taught the book last semester, and it's like, well, okay, what's the point of entry here? It's a pronoun. But people are going to relate to that pronoun in very different ways. And the book makes a lot of that. It's a very powerful book for that reason. So I would say, yes, I'm in agreement with what you're saying. And, you know, autofiction performs work, and it performs work with particular genres. In that sense, it's a score, right? And it's theatrical, and it's processed in a community. I mean, I think the issue of truth, though, is something else, because, as I said earlier, I think different kinds of truth are subject to different kinds of verification. If you have a work of history, you have a sort of historical event that happened or didn't happen. If you have a work of testimony, you're not really being true necessarily to an event, but you're being true to an experience of an event. That's different. There's a second level of mediation. So levels of verifiability vis-a-vis testimony and history and fiction and autofiction are all different, I think. And this is sort of a response to what Lynn said. So the idea of there being a sort of single truth out there that transcends all these other genre things, I don't think that exists.
And I don't think that most of these writers think that it does. Just to give another Knausgaard example, but like the, he writes all that stuff down, and it's almost like automatic writing, because he writes like 15, 20 pages a day. And that's an interesting auto-self is back again in that formulation. But there's also this question where he'll say, I'll ask my brother, like, did that really happen that way? And he'll say, no, and then he'll be like, yeah, it did. Because he doesn't care. And a lot of this stuff, like performativity, he also wants to enact the fantasy of direct communication. And it's a brazenness. He knows all of this performativity stuff. Like, he's completely absorbed it. And he's brazenly saying, no, this is direct. This is myself. It's a novel. It's me on the page. And so I think that, yeah, I don't think that, I think the point about most of these writers is that they are over worried, you know, about this distinction, and they're not. They do find a truth in narrative and a truth in fiction, and you know, they're not naive about it.
Follow that up. One question. So, why do you think there's this emphasis? Why do you think there's a need, let's say, for writers to be more? If this is the case, just for argument's sake, for more performativity in their work. What do you think that might, why might that be?
Reading has become very socialized now in a way that it maybe wasn't 10 years ago. I don't know why that is exactly. The performance of the self in various public and private spaces is something that we deal with much more now than we used to, I think. I think it's just a very complicated set of cultural and social things that have been happening, and they've affected, literary production and genre negotiation, I guess is how I would describe it.
So I had a question about the relationship between auto theory and auto fiction. And I was just wondering, like, if, so I was really smitten with Maggie Nelson's Argonauts, and wondering if she were to suddenly come out and say, well, I was never pregnant, I never, you know, my partner never transitioned, what would that do to her writing? In the same way as if Eileen Miles were to say, you know, none of these things ever happened, I was never in, you know, obviously it's kind of verifiable, but what would that mean, and what does it mean that we now have a new relationship between something like auto fiction and auto theory versus just fiction and theory? Is there a difference? I don't know.
How would you react? Is that...
I think it'd be kind of cool, but I think it'd also be kind of weird. But...
Did I start this? I just don't think that's a kind of hypothetical. I don't know how valuable it is, actually, because that book wouldn't be written in if those weren't true. And actually, it is important that those are true things on the one level, because they're easily verifiable. You know, Harry Dodge is a well-known artist and all of that. So I don't know. I think Maggie Nelson wouldn't be the writer she is in that. So I guess I don't know if that helps with that. And Eileen is actually a different case because, you know, are we talking about Chelsea Girls or... Because any of her fiction or, you know, or Inferno even, I don't think Eileen would sit here and say that was true necessarily, in the sense of it bears a close resemblance to actual lived reality. I would say she would say it's true in the sense of it being her experience of the world at that time, how she remembers it much later. But I don't know. I don't think she would come down on either side of that. I think she would...
Right. And I think this is why the interest in verifiability is so interesting, because verifiability becomes sort of a kind of crucible when that experience intersects with a lot of other people that have had the same experience. So this is a big issue with Holocaust literature. It was an issue with, you may know this story about the guy Yasusada, right, an invented figure who claimed to have been a victim of the Hiroshima bombing. Then he wrote a series of poems. The poems were sent out to the Paris Review and the APR with a note saying, well, he was a Hiroshima victim. Of course, they published it, but then he revealed afterwards that he wasn't a Hiroshima victim, although he never acknowledged his authorship. It's believed to be this person, Ken Johnson. So again, this raises all sorts of those issues about the kind of, you know, I have to call it like pre-contractual arrangement with a particular kind of writing. This is really about, you know, it was sort of, I don't know, the beautiful literature of victimization in the Yasusada case, and how that would play out with the contemporary American literary prep, you know, publication, a number of publications.
Yeah, so. And just thinking about the Yasusada and the Holocaust memoir, I mean, there's this other category that's emerging of like a kind of predatory literature that sort of constructs these narratives that might resemble a kind of personal story but are meant to kind of tug at your heartstrings. I mean, the Yasusada thing was interesting because part of the thing that emerged out of that conversation was sort of white liberal desire for a poet like that to exist, and sort of Ken John, if whoever it was. So I think that was a part of that conversation. So I guess I don't know if I'm getting at what. Yeah.
Comment, sorry. What helps me think about these issues is to separate the text from the author and think about the text in itself having a life of its own. So the text has a self that will outlive the author's self, and the self of the text is also changing all the time depending on when you read the text. So if you read the same text 100 years from now, that text will have a different self and a different life. And then the second point about autofiction and related to this notion of performativity is instead of looking at the author's self in the fiction as the real self of the author, it really points to the construction, the constructed nature of selfhood of the author. So if you think about selfhood as a construction in itself, I think that's
For me, sort of autofiction makes that clear. So, yeah.
I mean, it's the observation about the text outliving the author is not even always so guaranteed anyway. I mean, books exist in so many different forms and in so many different genres. Sometimes they last for, you know, the distribution networks that allow these things to go on disappear, and sometimes they take the text with them. So I'm also interested in that kind of literature that's kind of rendered invisible because it's kind of contingent on that kind of that those kind of networks. And this became an issue, actually, to go back to Lynn's point about the 80s and sort of all these artists who disappeared and all of their work went with them because the families that didn't have the kind of ability to store that work threw it out, you know, so.
That seems like an extremely sober note to end on. But, yeah, writing against death. Let's all do that. Well, thank you so much, Tan and Jonathan and Andrew.